So $40 pledge, fiction, nonfiction, we'll send you with our thanks a book. And we hope that you will enjoy it. And then maybe you pass that on to somebody else, and that book will go round and round.
And just to show you how crazy they are, before they send you the book, they take the hardback jacket off, and then they put it back on upside down.
That's really crazy.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that's the deal, folks. And we'd really, I know that there are people who look forward to this program and who save their pledge. Or maybe you could make an additional pledge. Whatever. We'd really like to hear from you this morning and get in as many people as possible. So the number to pledge, 244-9455. You may make a collect pledge call if we would be long distance, so put on the area code 217-244-9455. And, of course, here on the program, what we do is if people want to call in, maybe they would like to recommend a book, something that you have read recently you thought was particularly good. You can do that, too. Use the regular call-in number for Focus, which is 333-9455. And if that isn't all confusing, you're a better man than I. Oh, one more thing. We also have a challenge. A couple in Urbana appreciates the variety that we have, variety of topics we have on the show, and the way we approach the program. And they say that they will add $200 to the pledge total if at least 25 people pledge today during Focus. And I think that that's certainly doable. When we've done these book giveaways in the past, I think we've done, 15, 20, upwards of 20. So get to work now, folks. 244-9455. That's the number to call. Now, if I haven't used up the entire first hour with all of that, we'll say hello to Philip Matania.
Hello.
It's so nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
I feel that's been a long time since we've done this.
It's been an awfully long time.
Well, what have you been reading lately? Who wants to go first?
Well, Tanya says she has a really terrifying book. So let's get that. I don't know. You want to get that over with?
Sure. Let's get this over with. Okay. This is a memoir. It's called Goat, and it is by a gentleman named Brad Land. And it's a very, very controversial story. This young man and his brother, who is, I think, just 1 year older than he is, they live in a small town. They are the best of friends, closest two brothers could ever want to be. They are very bright, and they plan to go to college together. They don't want to be separated. They don't have a lot of other friends in their town, and so they want to stick together. So one of the things that goes on in their town, though, because it is a college town, and I grew up in one too, not this one. One of the things that goes on in their town is that there's a lot of fraternity and sorority activity there. It's a big Greek system there. And these boys are from this town and don't want to go to the same college that in the town that they grew up in, as I didn't. And just didn't want to stay at home, you know. Mm-hmm. And they spent a lot of time kind of poking fun at and really giving hard time to the fraternity. Not really giving them a hard time, but just between themselves and between the other, what we call townies, in that community, they really make fun of the fraternities a lot, and sort of think they're all a bunch of dumb jocks and just drunken fools and whatever. However, at the same time that they feel this, there's nothing to do in their town. It's a very wee town. And so a lot of them, they're still in high school. One of them's just graduated from high school. So they spend a lot of time hanging out at fraternity parties on the weekend.
Good
where
idea.
They consume an awful lot of alcohol and get into an awful lot of little altercations with these fraternity-type people.
Mm-hmm.
One night they are at this party, at a fraternity party, and he mentions... he tells you what fraternity this is. I think that's why some of the controversy surrounding it.
Oh.
He tells you where and which and exactly what happened. So anyway, this is all steeped. Everyone, this is all just steeped in absurd amounts of alcohol. Everyone involved, wildly drunk. Two of the young men in the fraternity ask the older brother if he will give them a ride somewhere. And he says, I'm sorry, I can't drive anywhere. I'm, too intoxicated. And they say, well, we can drive. You come with us. We'll drive your car. For some strange reason, he goes with them. And they proceed to take him out into the middle of nowhere and pull him out of the car and beat the hell out of him and leave him pretty much for dead in the middle of nowhere. And they steal his car. They leave. He claws his way through the woods. What he later realizes, he didn't know at the time, but what he later realizes is about 9 miles through the woods until he finds a farmhouse with a light on. And he claws his way to the door and knocks on the door, and they say, "My God," and they call the police and the ambulance and his father and all of these things. Well, after this incident, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the community about it. They do eventually identify the boys who did it. He just calls them the smile and the breath, though, because that's all he can remember about them, is the one guy's smile and the breath of the other guy. The younger brother, who's actually kind of more the socially capable one, he has the easier time making friends and whatever, and he's kind of a guardian for his older brother, even though they're both very bright. He has tremendous guilt for letting his brother go off with these two boys, for not being aware, for not knowing where he was, for not having stopped it somehow. What happens to the older boy, the victim of this crime, is that his mind really changes on him after this. And it's not really clear. And, you know, he's the author of this book, and it's very carefully written. It's very sparse and very detailed and yet sparse. And he writes kind of the way that he thinks. And after he had this trauma, you can tell that his mind has really changed some. Something's missing. Something is not there that once was. He's really lost something here. And he chooses, makes the decision not to go to college because he just can't handle it, at least not now. But he tells his brother, please, you know, don't throw your life away. Go to college and, you know, I'll be fine. So the brother goes off to college, a good college that they both had planned to attend. And when he comes home for Thanksgiving break, what has he done but joined a fraternity?
Not the fraternity.
Not the fraternity.
Not the same one.
Yeah. Not the same fraternity, but a fraternity, yes. And, you know, his brother, of course, doesn't understand why he's done this. And this is the story of how this happens, how... Because there's a lot of stereotypes surrounding these organizations. A lot of them true, a lot of them not. You know, can't judge a whole organization by the actions of several men, of course.
You can't judge a keg by its outline.
Yeah. That's right. That's right, Philip. Only Philip brings humor to a story this tragic. Okay, so he... it really shows you, the book shows you how intelligent, thoughtful people can be sucked in to this type of thing. Because what happens is...
I've always wondered.
I
want to read this.
Me too. I've always wondered too. And it really sort of guides you through, because I'll be honest, I've had an awful lot of stereotypes about these types of people in my life. I grew up in a college town. Now I live in one, you know. But this really gives you some insight into how this happens. How people... go ahead and give up everything they know to join a bunch of strangers. What happens the next year is that the brother, the traumatized brother...
You're making Philip nervous.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I just to say, see, the thing is, I've been doing this show with these people for a long time. And
I was waiting for her to cross the line.
And Tanya, she...
I might be about to cross
really, she gets in the story so much, see. She wants to tell
great.
You about it. But then, which is great. But Philip... being a, you know,
he's panicked.
This, being a writer, he's panicked because he's afraid she's going to give away too much. See, and so always some point comes. He starts getting nervous because he knows that he's feeling like no, stop there.
Don't give it away. Yeah. Anyway, I must tell you this because everything I've said so far happens in the first quarter of the book, I guess. Okay, so what happens is the next year his brother gets up some courage. He's terribly lonely. He misses his brother a lot, and he really just wants to get back into the world. And he's had some time to recover from the trauma. So he goes and joins his brother at college, and he's thrilled to see his brother. And guess what happens?
He joins
his fraternity. Brother convinces him to pledge this same fraternity that he is in. And so he does. Okay, I'm going to sort of stop there and just say that the rest of the book is about the hazing that goes on in these, in this particular named organization. And it is just revolting. It is whatever the worst things you can think of about hazing, everything, the whole 80s boom of that stuff and the controversy over it, whatever you can. And that's when this took place, too, was in the 1980s when all of this was really coming to the forefront. The worst thing you can think of, it's just twice as revolting as that. You have no idea the horrors.
Maybe I won't read it.
The absolute horrors. Yeah. Oh, absolute horrors. And okay, one last thing that's interesting about this young man is that he—I won't tell you how it ends or what happens.
Okay. Don't. Just stop at the second to last page.
No, no. He collects things. He doesn't know why, but he collects things. He keeps receipts. He keeps empty cigarette boxes. He keeps bottle caps. Just little things that he acquires all over campus throughout all this hell that he's going through. And remember, of course, that while he's, you know, pledging this fraternity, his brother is there watching all of this. His best friend, the person who loves him most in the world, is there watching and occasionally, not frequently, but occasionally encouraging it.
Yeah, okay. This is, it's titled GOAT, and it is a memoir, right?
It's
not
memoir.
A novel. This is
this, is, this, is,
this
such
is
a
one,
true story.
One person's
such
his,
a true
his
story.
Account of what it is that he experience.
Yeah.
Here this morning on The Focus, it's the good book show that we do occasionally with our two guests, Tanya Leotsakis from Pages for All Ages Bookstore, and Philip Graham, who's professor of English, and occasionally they're here on the show, and they bring in books that they have read lately that they thought were good and recommend them. So you can do that. Maybe we want to make notes. We also will have these books listed on our website. So if you have internet, go to WILL.UIUC.EDU, and you can get that way. Or I suppose, I'm sure if people don't have internet and they would just like a list, we could have one printed up and we could send it to you. Also, if there's a book that you would like to recommend, you can do that too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Okay, now, Philip, your turn.
Yes, I'd like to talk a little bit about a book, a novel called The Savage Girl by Alex Shakar, who actually is a writer who's going to come here and be one of my new colleagues in the fiction section of the MFA program. And this is a wonderful novel that is set in a sort of alternative, the United States. The town, Middle City, is located on the side of an active volcano. And yeah, and the main character, Ursula Van Erden, is just gotten a job as a trend spotter for Tomorrow Limited. In other words, to see what's going to be big next year or tomorrow or the day after, and to try to take advantage of it in some way and sell that knowledge to various people. And I'd like to, because I love this section. This is a section that when I read this to my son, we kept looking for the paradescence of things for weeks afterwards.
The what, Philip?
The paradescence.
What a writer.
Oh, no, this is in the book.
You mean that's not a real word? That's a made-up word?
Well, I think it's a real word.
Well, all words are made-up words, of course.
Yes, well, yeah, but I think because of this novel, it's now a real word. And anyway, so this sequence is when Chaz is taking Ursula into a supermarket, and he's trying to teach her some of the things that she needs to pay attention to in this job. So they're in the coffee section. All right, he says, what do you smell now? Coffee. The scent draws them into the next aisle. It comes primarily not from the prepackaged coffee, but rather from the gourmet stuff in plastic dispensers. What's the paradescence of coffee? Chaz asks her. Paradescence? She came across the word essence in a couple of the marketing books she skimmed, usually attached to some glim distillation of the product's selling points. But paradescence, what could that mean? Something paradise-like, perhaps. She takes a shot. I guess something about how it wakes you up, maybe, or the way it warms you up on a cold morning. Waking and warming, Chaz says. Very close. Now think. Locate the magic. Locate the impossibility. The impossibility? I don't know. Being warm? That's kind of like being sleepy, I guess. The paradescence of coffee is stimulation and relaxation. Every successful ad campaign for coffee will promise both of those mutually exclusive states. Chaz snaps his fingers in front of her face. That's what consumer motivation is about, Ursula. Every product has this paradoxical essence, two opposing desires that can promise to satisfy simultaneously. The job of a marketer is to cultivate this schismatic core, this broken soul at the center of every product. Chaz starts walking again, leaving her frozen in place. Ursula, herself, is shivering with revelation. She feels like she's getting a glimpse into the secret laws of reality. This must be the way the physicist who discovered quantum mechanics felt when he worked out the last decisive equation and realized that the basis of all the universe's laws might very well be a set of fundamental flaws. Around her, the supermarket has transformed into something rich and strange, a metaphysical playground, a fantastic space station at the bottom of a black hole where all the light and color goes. Light and color everywhere, and not a single shadow. The fluorescence is like some eye that sees every inch of you from every angle. She feels giddily powerful, nauseatingly vulnerable. The paradoxical sensation of vertigo. All right, next lesson, Chaz says. Listen, what do you hear? Muzak, she says, trying to concentrate. They are pushing their cart through yet another aisle. She wants to ask him about every product she sees. What's the paradescence of a mayonnaise substitute? What's the paradescence of pinto beans? But his demeanor doesn't invite questions. He walks next to her tensely. He doesn't seem to be comfortable here. When he's not speaking, she can see his jaw working, grinding his molars to dust. Muzak, he nods. What's it for? To make people shop more? Good guess. How? I don't know. I guess it's kind of happy and upbeat. It makes some people feel more at ease, not in such a rush, makes them look around more, count their pennies a bit less. That's the prevailing theory, Chaz says. A dissenting opinion is that it makes people shop more because it makes them more anxious. Either way, it works. Better than silence, better than any other kind of sound that's been experimented with. I could show you 100 studies. He pauses, his eyes moving uneasily among the shelves. Then he goes on, his voice rapid and tense, to really understand why it works. You've got to think about what Muzak is. Pop music is all about the time it's composed in. It becomes a way we measure our decades here on Earth, a way we distinguish one era from another. Muzak, conversely, is all about timelessness. It takes pop tunes out of time, cans them, pickles them, preserves them for eternity. This is the paradescence of music, eternal transience. Different people react to this contradiction in different ways. Some find it comforting because it reaffirms a fatuous hope that every insignificant event in their piddling little lives is actually important, is actually being recorded in some cosmic database somewhere. Muzak likers are immortal souls traveling through a material wonderland, and so what the hell, why not buy anything pretty that catches their eyes? Muzak haters, on the other hand, are terrorized by the stuff, because it turns everything unique about every era into the same homogeneous mush, and moreover does so with ease, thus reinforcing their suspicions that there's essentially nothing unique about their era or themselves, that their cherished individuality is nothing but a merchandised illusion begrudgingly maintained for them by marketers, that when you get right down to it, it's all the same crapola. Chad stops talking as though he'd lost his train of thought. Eventually it becomes clear that he isn't planning to add anything further. But how could that feeling make people want to shop more, she asks. He shrugs. Nihilists make for fairly avid consumers. Plenty of studies on that one, too. But aren't there people out there who Muzak makes so anxious that they end up shopping less? Statistically insignificant. Besides, nowadays, we've got medications for people like that.
Very nice.
I understand. Paradescence.
Yeah.
Once
you go into a store and you can apply it to practically everything.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Wow, all right. The book is The Savage Girl by Alex Shekar. And you say he is going to be joining
He's going to be in the fiction faculty next this fall.
Very good. Well, we might have to have him come over.
Oh, you bet.
Over them. Very good. Philip Graham and Tony Laitsakis here. We're talking about great new books and something occasionally we do. And I'm sorry to say it's been a while since they've been here because it's always fun. Mm-hmm. They come and they bring books. Now, Philip likes to read passages, and Tanya just likes to tell you the entire
story.
Give away
the endings.
and
we still get along.
Still
friends.
Yeah. And I know that as a result of – I have read some of the books that they have recommended. I'm sure people listening to us have, and they appreciate that as one little facet, one little piece of the package of stuff that we do on this program. Now, here's the important thing, ladies and gentlemen. You like to read, don't you? You like books, don't you? We got a lot of them. We'd like to find homes for them. All we're asking is that you make a pledge, and if you'll do that, we will send you a book. Jack Brighton is here, the other half of Crazy Dave and Jack, former Focus producer,
that's
current
right.
web
and crazy.
Maestro, and he's crazy. Believe it. Believe me, I've known this guy for how long now?
It's been 17 years almost. Isn't that astonishing?
Lately people keep doing that. People keep, regular guests, they keep coming in here and say, well, you know, Dave, we've been doing this show for 37 years. And, you know, I keep saying, no, I don't want to hear that. Don't tell me how long we've been doing it. 244-9455. We want people to call in and make a pledge, and if you do that, you'll get a book.
Absolutely right. We've got fiction. We've got your nonfiction. We've got all kinds of great books. And these are grade A, high quality, highly regarded books that the publishers send us because, after all, they want us to put their authors on the air because Focus 580 has a certain cachet among, you know, the book publishers, mm-hmm. or at least we're on their mailing list. So they send us all these books, and we do a lot of author interviews on the air, and then we have all these books left over. So we'd love to share them with you, and all you have to do is call us with a basic membership pledge. The number to call, 217-244-9455, and make a pledge. It'll just take a minute. We've got people standing by. They've been very, very busy this morning. But not too busy to take your pledge call, so please do that now. And I think we also have a challenge going.
Yes, we do. That? Yeah, I would mention that challenge. This is a challenge that comes from a couple in Urbana that say they appreciate the variety of topics that we feature on the show and the way that we approach the interviews. And they say they will add $200 to the pledge total if at least 25 people pledge today during Focus. And I think, you know, earlier this morning we had a record. We set a record for greatest number of calls during Morning Edition.
Wow.
Maybe we could set a record for greatest number of pledge calls during Focus 580. And I'll bet 25 would be close to what the record would be.
Yeah,
we've done more. I don't know.
I think we have done more. We certainly, whenever we offer the book giveaways, we get people calling like crazy. Hmm. Because, after all, it is Crazy Dave and Jack's book giveaway. the record this morning was set, 113 pledges during Morning Edition. That is just really astonishing. But here's the thing. We really have to keep on track because the goal for the day is $140,000 raised, so far during the week, and we have a ways to go. So we really need each and every call, and please don't think that a small pledge isn't going to help us much. The important thing is that you do call and join the Friends of WILL. If you've never done that, it's, a group of people who support what we're doing here on the air with their small contributions, the basic membership level, $40 a year, that's 11 cents a day. If you think of it that way, 244-9455. And why don't we quickly see, I know we've got some phones ringing. Let's check in with Maeve Riley, our Patterns Magazine program guide editor, and find out how crazy is it out there, Maeve?
It's pretty crazy right now. And actually, we're a half person away from hearing from 25 people. So we've heard from 12 people.
Whoa.
I don't know if we can get a half person to give us a call, but we've got a few phones ringing here. And, Philip, I wanted these listeners to be in a paradescent state.
Oh, yeah.
To be speaking and also listening at the same time. So give us a call, 217-244-9455. Give us a pledge, get a book, support public broadcasting.
All right. Shall we give some phone number one more time? We really want to encourage people to do this because we got lots and lots of good books.
Absolutely.
And we want to find homes for them.
Can I say something about that book, though? When they send a book, this book didn't have to be a book. It could have been a Kleenex. It could have been a Post-it note.
Yeah.
It could have been a popsicle stick.
Interesting.
It could have been a 2x4. But no, it decided to become a book so you could read it.
Absolutely.
And it's the least you could do is to welcome that book
that's right.
into your home. And
they're
at the same time,
support us.
They're homeless. You know, they made their choice, and you should honor that.
Well, the other thing about this is this book, as it chose to be a book, it still has not reached its full potential until somebody reads it.
Its intellectual still has not been realized. Yes.
We want you to help self-actualize these books. Call us with your pledge. 217-244-9455, and we'll send you either a fiction or a nonfiction book. And also, I want to also mention that you can pledge on the website and do the same thing. There's a text box you can fill out. Just say, I'd like a book, fiction or nonfiction. Say whichever it is you'd like. WILL.UIUC.EDU is the website. Either the phone or the website is good.
All right. We have a caller here into the program who'd like to talk with us. We will do that. And I also want to issue the same offer to people who are listening. If there was a book that you would like to recommend, you can do that. Same number as always we use for the show, 333-9455. toll-free 800-222-9455. So let's do that. We'll talk with listener in Downs, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. First of all, I have to tell you that I absolutely love this program, and although it does not apply today, never lose the motto, dare to be dull.
Oh, thank you very much. We're proud of it.
It is. There are things that you just hear nowhere else. And this program drives me crazy because I get nothing done. I plan to get something done. It's nice that it's up on the website now because I don't have to madly scribble at least.
Mm. Yes. We're trying to make that a little easier so people don't have to do that.
I can get slightly other things done. but I have an author that I have recommended before, and I have just read a second book of his. The book is Interior Design. I called in before and recommended how to read an unwritten language.
Oh, thank you.
It is Philip Graham, of
thank
course.
Thank you. Good.
Please read his books, listeners out there. He is a wonderful author. He comes on and talks about other people's books all the time. But I have really enjoyed the ones that I have read of his. So thank you, Philip.
Well, thank you.
And thank you, David,
the
for
check
the
is in the mail.
Sure.
God.
Who is this woman, Philip?
I don't know, but I think she's a highly, very discerning person.
I see. She is, yes.
Uh-huh. Oh.
Thank you. Well,
very good book.
Thank you for the kind words. And I would second that because I think I have tried to recommend to people, particularly how to read an unwritten language.
Thank you.
Wasn't there some rumor there was going to be another novel?
Actually, I just got workshopped on campus for a novel that I'm finishing up this summer. I'm actually finishing two novels this summer, so you know, that happens to me. I tend to have a big backlog of books I'm working on at the same time, and then they all come at once.
Yeah.
So that's long stretches of silence, and then I'm too many places.
All right. When would we expect these things to see?
I dare not predict.
No. Right. Really,
but they will be done.
In the meantime, though, How to Read an Unwritten Language is truly
thank you.
A remarkable
God.
Novel.
Yeah.
Loved it.
We gotta
loved
show.
It before I ever met the man.
We
got to
do
so.
The show more often.
All right. Well, let's see. Tanya did a book. Philip did a book. So I guess Tanya. We're back to Tanya.
Okay. Now, speaking of writers.
I never heard of this guy. Who is this guy?
Oh. Well, this is Philip Roth, and he has an awful lot of novels. He's pretty famous, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. This book is called The Dying Animal, and I just have to put a disclaimer and say, no offense about this character now, Philip.
Oh.
This character is a writing professor.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
Uh-oh.
And literature professor. And he is just a hoity-toity guy at a hoity-toity university. Nothing like this.
Nothing
man we
like
know
this.
Here.
No, he's just a regular guy at a sort of run-of-the-mill.
Yeah,
university.
There you go.
Oh, but anyway, his name is David, and boy, you sure will hate him in the beginning. Mm-hmm. He has a habit of, it's not just a habit, I mean, it's his life goal, really, to seduce his female students.
Yuck.
Yeah. So, and he's been doing this all his life. When the book begins, he's 62 years old and still doing it, still seducing his 19-year-old students. He's been married and divorced. Imagine that.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And he has a son who hates him a lot.
Surprise.
Here's the thing about this guy. You hate him, but there's something about him. Well, first of all, he's brilliant. First of all, the guy's brilliant, which is why everyone's drawn to him in the first place. He also makes a lot of really good points about marriage and why he's so very against the whole prospect of it. This is a little bitty book. But there's a lot going on. And I read the first half of this, and I will say this. It is just plumb full of sex. Just absolutely cram-packed full of sex. And that was about the first half of the book. And while interesting, I said, okay, I see where this is going, and, you know, the guy will be remorseful and whatever, you know. And I put it down. And then I picked it up again a few weeks later, and I finished it, and boy, was I surprised.
Really, yeah.
Boy, was I surprised. This gentleman meets a woman, a student,
named Consuela, who is the daughter of Cuban exiles. And she's a lovely young woman and very smart and in his one of his classes. And they have an affair, which lasts about a year and a half. And then it breaks off, and you know, like all of his affairs do. They usually don't last nearly that long. But what happens is this freedom that he's been searching for and this, you know, ability to stay unattached to anything, to his child, to his wife, to anything that would come along, even though he thinks he's still doing that, this woman really affects him. And, you know, he doesn't really mean much to her. He's kind of a novelty, kind of an experiment, whatever. But long after she's gone, he's consumed by her. And just to give you an idea of why you'll hate him and why you'll kind of respect him in a way, too, it's really a confusing way to feel about a person. He has a woman years later after this. He's about 70 years old, and there's a woman named Elena who is not really a character in the story at all, but she's just a former student who's now grown, a grown professional, and they had had a fling back when she was his student in college, many, many years before. And she comes to him desperate that she can't, he just feels like an old friend to her. And she goes there, and he hasn't seen her in years, and she says, you know, I've been trying to get married. She's an ophthalmologist now. She worked real hard on her career. She's very successful. And she's like, I've been trying to get married, and I can't find a man. I'm 40 years old, and I can't find a decent man. She actually admitted to going to matchmaking services, and which everyone in this book is going to find just absurd. Everyone in this book is very educated and very, you know, they just think that was just plain silly. So they have a good laugh over that. She says, I've been on 19 dates. Isn't that enough? Didn't I give it a fair shot? And he said, yes, that's more than a fair shot. So this is the speech that he gives her after she comes to him saying, oh, do you have any advice? What can I do? You know, what's it like not to be married all this time? Okay, so I'll read a passage. Elena was a mess that night. She stayed right through till dawn when she rushed off to scrub up at the hospital. Neither of us got much sleep because I was lecturing on the necessity of her giving up on the idea of becoming coupled and because she was listening like the diligent, serious, note-taking student she'd been when we'd first met in my classroom. But whether I helped her, I don't know. Elena's intelligent, tremendously capable, yet for her, the desire for a child is the standard unthinking. Yes, the idea activates the propagative instinct, and that's the pathos of it, all right, but it's still part of the standard unthinking. You go on to the next step. It's so primitive for someone so accomplished. But this is the way she imagined adulthood long, long ago, before adulthood, before diseases of the retina became her life's passion. What did I say to her? What do you ask? You too need the lecture of the childishness of coupling. Of course it's childish. Family life is today, more than ever, when the ethos is created substantially by the children. It's even worse when there are no children around, because the childish adult replaces the child. Coupled life and family life bring out everything that's childish in everyone involved. Why do they have to sleep night after night in the same bed? Why must they be on the phone to each other 5 times a day? Why are they always with each other? The forced deference is certainly childish, that unnatural deference. In one of the magazines, I read recently about a famous media couple married 34 years and the marvelous achievement of their learning to bear each other. Proudly, the husband told the reporter, "My wife and I have a saying that you can mark that you can tell the health of a marriage by the number of teeth marks on your tongue." I wonder when I'm around such people, what are they being punished for? 34 years. One stands in awe of the masochistic rigor required. I have a friend in Austin, a very successful writer, married young in the mid-1950s, then in the early 70s got divorced, married to a decent woman with whom he produced 3 decent children, and he wanted out. And he didn't get out hysterically or foolishly. It was a human rights issue. Give me liberty or give me death. Well, after the divorce, he went off to live alone and at liberty, and he was miserable. And so within a short time, he married again, a woman this time with whom he didn't plan to have any children, who already had a college-age child of her own, a married life without children. Well, sex had to be over in a couple of years, yet this is a man who was vigorously adulterous throughout his first marriage and focused on sex in his writing.
On his own, he could have begun to enjoy openly all that he had finagled surreptitiously while married. Yet unsprung from his constraints, he's miserable from the first second and believes that he'll be miserable forever. Hmm. He is at liberty in the face of the fullness, and he has no idea where he is. All he knows to do is to find his way back into the condition he could no longer stand, though now without the compelling logic of wanting to be married so as to have children, to raise a family, etc. The charm of the surreptitious? I don't disparage it. Marriage, at its best, is a surefire stimulant to the thrills of licentious subterfuge. But my friend's need was for something more basic to his safety than the adulterer's daily drama of fording a river of lies. That wasn't the kick he remarried for. Even though once he was a husband again, he almost immediately resumed pursuing the old delights. Part of the problem is that emancipated manhood never has had a social spokesman or an educational system. It has no social status because people don't want it to have a social status. Yet this fellow's circumstances so favored living to the limit of his prerogatives, if only for the dignity of it. But deferring, 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 appeasing, 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 every other day dreaming of leaving? No, it's not a dignified way to be a man. Or, I told Elena, to be a woman.
Hmm. Philip Roth, a man with a deserved reputation.
Yeah. Look at Philip.
Now Philip Graham's, he's got a chaser for that, I think.
I have an answer to that. I'm happy to say I've been with the same woman for 30 years, and so I'm going to have someone else give a counter argument. This is a wonderful book by the writer Charles Dickinson, a collection of stories called With or Without. It's shamefully out of print. A lot of the stories, most of the stories in this collection first appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, Esquire, Grand Street, elsewhere. And this story is one of my very favorite short stories ever. And it's called Risk. And it's about this sort of traveling risk game, you know, the game of risk that you conquer the world and so forth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there are about six or more people who go from house to house, you know, every week, and they play Risk. And they're kind of, if not friends, they're sort of, you know, acquaintances who are held together by playing this game. Mm-hmm. And as they sit around playing Risk, and the story takes place in the kitchen of one of the characters, Owen. All it is people playing Risk. But because this is fiction, and because fiction gives us access to the interior of characters, we know what the people who are playing this game are also doing in their lives. And it turns out, as you're reading, without, you know, the author being too brazen about giving it away, is that everybody is engaging in risks in their own lives, whether it's riding a motorcycle, you know, too fast on the way over to play Risk, or doing too many drugs, or in the case of two people who are playing this game of just having had their first assignation, the beginning maybe of an affair. And one of the things that it really becomes clear, and becomes clear especially in relation to the passage that I'm going to read, that a lot of the risks that they're taking are really trivial risks. You know, they're almost all of them risks that are really no risks at all, because they're all a rushing away from intimacy. In fact, the fellow who sleeps with one of the women participants in this game, his own wife is someone who seems to always want to be engaged and so forth. And why he wants to sleep with this woman and does is because there's really nothing there in her mind. He's just attracted to her physically. But there's another story here, and that is that Owen, the person who is the host of the game this night, he keeps going back into the house to talk to his wife and see if she wants to come out and say hello. And she doesn't want to, and she's being very private. And every time he goes back, you get a sense that something has gone wrong. It turns out when he stops by the open door of an empty room, we see that they've lost a child recently, a baby. You know, there's the crib is still there. And that they really have not been together as a couple since then. It's too terrifying almost to think about having sex because of what that could lead to. And at one point, Owen goes out into the outside to say goodbye to one of the characters, and something that is said makes him realize, you know, what's going on in this incipient affair between two of the participants. And that seems to set something off in him. because of the steady isolation between him and his wife that can't really help him. He can't get involved in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So he returns to the house. He returns to his house through the front door. He hears the voices of the players in the kitchen, the labored buzz of an old digital clock turning a minute over. Through the dark passages of the house, moving with the freedom bestowed by his guests believing he is still outside, Owen glides into the bedroom. His wife lies wrapped and asleep. He understands now why the night's game offered him nothing. It was an event out of order of importance. Eileen comes half awake at the way he pulls the covers and makes a space for himself in the loose, warm cylinder. He gets her nightgown unbuttoned and untied and fights through the clumsy hands she throws in his path. He plants a long kiss on her sour mouth. She utters a word into his mouth that he ignores. She will kill his desire if he lets her. "Where are your friends?" she whispers, warm in his ear. "In the kitchen. The world will fall soon." "You aren't being a good host." He is stirred unimaginably to hear teasing in her voice. Her hands have opened against his back. "They think I'm outside," he whispers. "This way, I can be two places at once." She kisses him on the neck. They move on together. Owen, careful of dark chasms of memory, he must transport his wife over. She proceeds along a fine edge that her husband slowly widens.
Wow, fabulous.
And that's not the end of the story, but that's the true risk of the story. And in fact, what Dickinson says without having to say it is the true risk is the risk toward intimacy.
Not away from it.
Sure,
I understand. Yeah.
And so the trivia of everything that's going on while highly entertaining is that the life and death drama is going on in the back room, right, off stage in a sense from that game of
Risk.
What
is this collection?
Yeah, what's the
author's name
book?
Is Charles Dickinson, and the collection is called With and Without, and the story that I just read from Risk is one of the greatest stories I have ever read.
And out of print, but the library probably, yeah.
All right. Or you can get it through A Libris. Yeah. I got my copy through A Libris.
All right. We have another caller here. We have a few minutes here in this first hour of the show, but Philip and Tanya have agreed to stay with us for the whole morning. So 1 hour is never enough, and during the fundraiser time, we say, would you please spend both hours? And they have always said, of course they would.
We love it.
We have a caller to talk with here in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to recommend a book of nonfiction, Chalmer Johnson's newest novel, his newest work of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. The Sorrows of Empire. I think he was on Focus 580 with his book Blowback. I'm not sure.
Hmm. Yeah, I believe so.
Yes, the Sorrows of Empire, I think, is a must book, especially if you are the type of person where you hear the word civilian contractor and you think engineer instead of mercenary.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was like a decoder ring because so much of, I don't know, when I listen to the news, I have more questions afterwards than before.
Don't we all?
You bet.
If you have that type of feeling, then, mm-hmm. then you really need to read the book. His argument is that we have an empire of military bases. And he goes through all of these terrorist attacks that we've experienced, I think starting maybe with the coal. But he gives the explanations of how these aren't unexpected attacks. And explains why and how they're happening in this terms of a military basis. And it really explains a lot about our relationships with East Asia as well as the Middle East. I was just grateful for the book because sometimes I feel like George Orwell was wrong, that it wasn't 1984, it was 2004. And if you get that type of feeling, then you'll be grateful for the
book.
That's
a really great way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very good. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the recommendation.
Okay.
Thank you.
You.
We'll be here for another hour, and Philip and Tanya will talk some more about books that they have brought. And if I certainly want to make the same offer to people who are listening, that if there's a book that you have read that you would like to recommend, that's great. 333-9455. That is our local number here for Champaign-Urbana folks, and toll-free 800-222-9455 if you would like to call in. We've got to beg for some money here in a second or so. Can we do one? Is there one thing you might like to do that we could do fairly quick?
I could do quick. One? Do you have a quick one?
I've got a poem I could read.
Oh, read a poem.
Oh, yeah. This is from A poet who's become one of my very, very favorite poets. Her name is Mary Ruefle. It's spelled R-U-E-F-L-E. And this is from her latest book called Tristamania. And I just adore this particular poem, but the whole book. She has a very wild imagination, and it seems to go off in places you wouldn't expect. But when you read the poems over, you realize, you know, how intensely they make sense. This is called Italics Mine. And in the first line, there are some italics, and that's the phrase, we don't have to exist anymore, which is important when we come to the end of the poem. It's winter, and we don't have to exist anymore. The bittersweet takes over, and the wind generated by stars, but not in any maniacal fashion, more like newborn moles, naked and blonde before they begin to dig, which is instantly. The offspring of a morbid fancy and idle scratching becomes an ultimatum. And the can opener goes round and round until at last the soup lid falls in the soup, and we are slightly thankful for the thing we knew would happen, though later, filled with regret, as retrieving it proves hard and more embarrassing than the wine that keeps singing prettily on the finish, the crest jewel of discrimination at a party without ice. Thus, winter's a time when the dead can say anything, and it sounds like advice, while outside the cold Sufis grow impatient and angry while waiting to be devoured. They whirl away in a funnel of snow like skeletons dancing with pears. One species of mole can tunnel 7 feet per second, but that is going too far. Sometimes we have a sense of after all. But if we suddenly remembered everything we'd forgotten and forgot everything we usually remembered, we'd be totally different people. And then we don't have to exist anymore. And I love that. Think about it. If we suddenly remembered everything we'd forgotten and forgot everything we usually remembered, we would in fact be totally different people. How dependent we are on memory for who we think ourselves to be.
Isn't that true?
Love that poem.
We're coming near the end of the first hour, but Philip and Tanya will hang around here, and they'll tell us about some more books, and if there are people who are listening would like to recommend some, that would be great. We have some books that we'd like to find homes for. As we explained at the beginning of the program, because we have a lot of authors on the show, publishers know that, and they send us books. Sometimes we ask for them. Mostly we don't. And most of them are really good books, more than we could possibly ever do on the show. And sometimes we have giveaways here where we give them to staff members. Sometimes we box them up and we send them over to the various libraries and the campus units, the history library and women's studies and, you know, whatever. If we have a book that we think would be good for them, we'd say, here, have them. We try to share them. But we also save a good number when we have a fund drive because we use it as a way of saying to folks, hey, make a contribution. You'll help support the programs. And as a way of saying thanks, we will send you a book. So that's what we're doing here, and we'd like to hear from as many people as we possibly can this morning. At a record-breaking morning on Morning Edition, we'd like to set a record of our own. Jack Brighton is here in studio with me.
That's right. All you have to do is give us a call on the pledge line, 244-9455. Make a basic membership pledge, $40 for most people, or if you're a student or on fixed income, it's $25. That's an annual membership in the station, and we'll send you either a fiction or a nonfiction book. And all you have to do is say what you'd like. Just takes a minute. The number again, 217-244-9455. You know, David and I, we are rife with books.
Are we?
We have a book abundance.
Do we have a plethora?
Yes, indeed we have. In fact, you know, we're talking about
fluidity?
The different things that you can do with books. We have figured out so many things you can do with books. I, until recently, had my computer monitor stacked on books so that it, you know,
so
I didn't
get to the right height.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. Right.
That is not allowing the book to fulfill its destiny.
That's right.
Now. I have freed those books.
I have to tell you, I have to tell you now and again, there's a book that I think
free it's, Brighton's books. It's free Brighton's books.
Occasionally, I think, though, we have books that I think their destinies is to be used in step aerobics.
Yes. Well, you see, there is such a thing as a bad book, and we've seen plenty of them, right?
I'm sure. Well, and Phil, one of the things I have to say
about
Philip is...
We don't like to talk about them, though.
But he has given permission, if you start reading a book and you don't like it, it's not doing it for you, it's okay to say, I don't need to finish this.
That's right.
There
That's
are
right.
other books.
Yeah, you know, I have a hard time with that, too, though. Yeah. I have a hard time not finishing.
Oh, no, I'll stop. I'll
I'm
just
so worried
it.
That yeah. something fabulous will happen.
Well, as in The Dying Animal.
As in The Dying Animal.
There are examples of that.
There are examples of that. That's the danger, you know?
Mm-hmm. But we're not going to give away any bad books, okay? This is just the good stuff. So all you got to do is call us, 217-244-9455. Real quick, let's check in with Maeve Riley in the Pledge Center. Things had dropped off there for a minute.
Yes.
I can't believe that.
Yes, they have. And Jack, you know, that wall of books is growing greater and greater by your desk, and I'm afraid it's just going to crush you one day. So we need to get rid of some of those books.
We are in danger. Help us.
We are in danger. And also, there is a challenge going on, too. A couple in Urbana appreciate the variety of topics on Focus 580 and David Inge's excellent interviewing style. So they'll add $200 to the pledge total of at least 25 people pledged today during Focus 580. We've heard from just 13 people now, so we've got 12 more people we'd like to hear from before noon. So give us a call, 217-244-9455, and tell the volunteer if you'd like a fiction or nonfiction book, too.
Okay. We need to get in our market report.